this piece that I'm going to present here today, and which is really going to be part of C-Theory Books, Left Behind, the same title is the title of a best-selling 12 set of novels that were done by very important and influential American politicians and religious figures. And this is Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins, figures that I didn't know that much about, maybe till about 2 years ago. And then I kind of realized that these are 63 million copies of the Left Behind novels that have been sold, which are really the stories of apocalyptic end times, the return of Jesus, the rapture of Jesus' true followers into heaven, literally bodily, so that all that's left behind are most of the world's population who are not true believers, plus people's own clothes, their eyeglasses, hearing aids, things that are the prosthetics, right? So in some sense, they're pure flesh. And purity is really, in some sense, the core of the book, because I think a desire in a world where purity isn't so possible, where our borders are changing, our bodies are changing in relation to technology, our economy and culture are blurring, where the marketplace literally is entered into the interstices of everyday life, and there's really nothing to escape, in some sense, the constant judgment of the market. This desire for a kind of pure Christianity, a pure sense of righteousness, and a deep fundamentalism. I mean, these are fundamentalist ministers, that is LaHaye. Jerry Jenkins is a very popular writer, a number of bestsellers in the New York Times before the coming of these Left Behind novels. And the novels, in many ways, I think, speak directly to the political dilemma of the United States at this moment, a place when the United States claims to be defending freedom and liberty. And we're often concerned, but how can you be defending freedom and liberty when so many of the control policies to defend those seem to be reducing individual liberty? So, you know, the justification, literally, of physical torture in the name of freedom and so forth, in the name of law, in the name of spreading democracy. But these novels, to some degree, provide clues to what that means, because the meaning of freedom and liberty in these are really the freedom of conversion, the freedom in some sense of a pure existence under the aegis of grace rather than the aegis of democracy. And as we know, you know, a good deal of the political support for the current administration in Washington, the presidency of George W. Bush, is banned by people that are very serious about their Christian commitments, but their Christian commitments in some ways are unexamined historically. This isn't a Christianity that's been evolving with and developing spiritual attunement to changing historical times. Nor is it really a Christianity that many Christians would recognize as a gospel of love, a gospel of forgiveness, a gospel really of nonviolence. It's a gospel of righteousness and judgment and anger, much more in some sense inspired by Old Testament text. Although the main text theologically that guides these books is the somewhat poetic and certainly symbolic Book of Apocalypse or the Revelation. But the project for fundamentalist Christians in the U.S. at least is to read Apocalypse or Revelations as a literal text and to find historical analogs. So figures of the Antichrist, you're looking for the figure of evil, and it's very interesting that in the Left Behind books, the figure of the Antichrist becomes the head of the United Nations. And many, you know, for U.S. Conservative Christians, the United Nations is a secular group. It's a group that dissembles the possibility of a one-world religious system under Christianity and fears the coming of a one-world religious system, which it calls secular humanism. So in many ways, it's symptomatic, these books are, of the state of the U.S. right now in drawing boundaries between good and evil, trying to enact a kind of moral politics in the guise of democratic politics, but justifying things that existed in the Old Testament, violence against one's enemies, kind of sacrificial politics against those that oppose monotheism, and not just monotheism, but in some sense a very narrow spectrum of thought that in some sense is nostalgic for a time when there could be the possibility of the U.S. as a blessed nation, a nation chosen specifically by God. So when Americans sing now, in the early 21st century, America the Beautiful and God Bless America, this is the sort of mixture of a religious and now an increasingly economic and military virile sense of judgment on the world and judgment and righteousness. So in some sense, I was very interested that these themes exist. 63 million copies, pretty much more than any books that exist in English language. But more interesting to me than that is that my own colleagues in the academy, critical thinkers, critical studies of culture and so forth, know very little, and some people know very nothing really about these books at all, how influential they are, and there's an appeal to them, and there's a thriller sense to the novels themselves. I mean, they really build quickly over a 12-volume set. It begins with the project of the rapture. And then the rest of the world being left behind for 7 years of tribulation, and those ruled by the Antichrist, this sort of figure of evil, seductive figure that poses peace but really means war, you know, poses justice but really means tyranny, at least for those that believe in the Christian message. But the U.S. itself, as a country right now, in opposition to the United Nations, or not just bad-mouthing, but in some sense of withdrawing funds from, withdrawing cooperation from the United Nations, going to war, breaking international law, and the judgment of at least the head of the United Nations. It's very interesting that the United Nations becomes the figure of evil in this. It changes its name in the novels from the United Nations to Global Community. There's many themes in the novel that resemble really the coming of a kind of a homogenizing culture under the project of capitalist globalization, where economies are brought into the same scales, where everyone's judged by the same kind of market criteria, where everyone is asked to be calculative and rational in some capitalist way. And the novels oppose these, but not so much in the name of justice, but a higher order of purity, and in some sense a higher order of homogeneity, the final standard of Christianity. So I'm interested in their cultural value, the fact that they've been so influential to so many Americans, and their books. We talked about a period where post-book culture, people are paying attention to television or internet or new media technologies. I mean, these are books that people read. They read together in church communities. They develop a collective feel around them, and they really, in some sense, reproduce a kind of mythology of a righteous Christian order, but also the end of time. All the things that are complicated and contradictory, a world now in a post-colonial situation, a world where really there is seemingly one superpower, and maybe that isn't even the United States, maybe that's just the world market, where there's these governing bodies, the World Trade Organization, or the IMF and so forth, that are setting standards, that are reducing the diversity of culture, that may be reducing our participation in living matter, I mean, thinking of energy in natural senses or environmental terms, so all for the standards of profit. What's interesting, there's a criticism of all these kind of things in the book, in these books, but they're all then brought back to a higher standard of a righteous capitalism, a righteous understandings of the world that are full of vengeance and are full of anger. And really resemble much more, in my understanding, theologically, the Old Testament than the New Testament. But it's not surprising, then, that there's Old Testament study groups in the U.S. White House, or that meetings are sometimes opened in the White House with readings from the Old Testament. I know we're in a period of seemingly endless war, as it seemed like the Israeli community in the Old Testament was endlessly at war with its enemies, because it was the only monotheistic culture against a world where gods came in many forms. Seems part of the U.S. has chosen that as its mantra. How it affects our culture in the United States, how it should make others afraid of the United States in lots of ways if we're driving our foreign policy not based on possibility for negotiation or agreement, but absolute standards, absolute moral standards, and so forth, that come out of a non-negotiable stance with the world. Everything else is evil beyond some sense of purity. So several other things, in summary. I've always been concerned that our studies of technology and culture and politics should be returning to some real critical stance of often the unnoticed theological assumptions that go underneath these things, whether it's science or the development of new technology. And so that seems important to come to terms. Sociology, I'm a sociologist, and I was talking to Andrew about this earlier. And sociology had come almost to an understanding some 20 years ago, the secularization that increased rationality would be the evolution, really, in some sense, of the entire human community on the planet. Now we've seen the return of all kinds of fundamentalism. So I'm talking in this work about a kind of Christian fundamentalism in the West. So people are concerned with a kind of return to Islamic fundamentalism of certain type and so forth, and its connection with terror. The type in the Christian world should be connected politically with terror, because if we're concerned with the violation of human rights, whether it's in Iraq or in U.S. Prisons in Guantanamo Bay, or U.S. new sliding to what we can view torture as a legitimate technique of interrogation and so forth, these are all things that are disturbing religious base. The last thing that really drove me, I think, to want to write about this was my own contact with my many colleagues in the academy, who seemed genuinely puzzled at the re-election of President Bush in 2004. And how could this be when it was obvious to them that something like the Iraq war is a misgiven policy, an endless war against terrorism with no end, a misgiven policy. So who could be voting for Bush? And so many of us were not in day-to-day contact, probably most Americans, for instance, turned out, right? So those are some things that lead to this work.
That's good. And to the fundamentalists, it's like George Soros has a recent little book, but it's a really great book called The Age of Fallibility.
Yeah.
Adds to religious fundamentalism. He's said three strands of American thought. Mark, he adds market fundamentalism, and what he calls American supremacists. People you describe
as
the way
no, that's right, that's right.
Yeah, that's really good. So do you think these are like sublimated forms? The desire, like this kind of ecstatic panic desire for rapture and for purity. It's striking in terms of the actual contradictions of the political economy of the United States and racial divisions in society, which seem to be deepening, that these are in fact a real sublimations, really sort of displaced science or something else that's happening.
The sublimation displacement seems right, because some of these fundamentalisms in U.S. Christian Protestant thought really in some sense they begin in the 19th century. And they're at a period where Christianity was asked to justify the project of slavery, was asked to justify the really extermination of the indigenous peoples in North America, particularly the United States, or their colonization and reduction and so forth, or their conversion and bringing into monotheism and the like. And this, in some sense, begins the basis of fundamentalism, a return to some kind of principles. It's in many ways a denial of the more complex and contradictory complicities of Christianity with politics that are anything but Christian.
Yeah, but do you think America's always been a society of the left behind in terms of structural logic? So I think it started by the Puritans, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
They are left behind dispensationalist sense.
No, that's right.
So do you think this is not a part of a contrary notion which emerges now in response, or even in the 19th century, but it's part of a deep structural logic of America?
No, I do think it is. You could talk with his words now that are out there like American theodicy, but these are not new concepts. This is from the very, the founding fathers who wrote the documents of America and so forth were more deist, perhaps, than they were fundamentalist or Puritan in some level. But the population always desired, this was going to be a place, in the wilderness, like a new Israel or a new Jerusalem, really, where God's people would find its home.
But it strikes me there's something more virulent about this current Great Awakening, if it's that kind of echo.
Yeah, Third Great Awakening. Right?
Because of the imminence of the imminence of the destruction of the world as a very important motif.
Yes.
This isn't just kind of connected with the notion of the chosen people that's going to build a new Jerusalem or a shining city on the hill and so forth. The themes of world destruction and the Book of Revelation is absolutely front and center in a way that perhaps it wasn't before. I'm wondering why you think this might be. I mean, why has there been an acceleration of the sort of the blood and gore and destruction element within this kind of Christian fable?
Well, I think it's, as you're saying, first nuclear weapons, and now kind of we're learning that environmentally, perhaps we've already gone on, crossed the threshold or nearing the threshold, where really the possibility of life is going to be disappearing. So, to some degree, to translate that into really apocalyptic religious terms, in some ways, is like a displacement or a denial of the materiality of what is leading to the possibility of destruction. On the other hand, I think one thing that's interesting to me about the novels is the place of the body in the novels, and the place literally of the lived flesh. The novels begin in a curious way with a Christian pilot tempted to break his marriage vows. And so this kind of anxiety, you know, in a world that's highly sexualized in a commercial sense, in a world where sexuality isn't so much about intimacy or bonding or the possibility of even a kind of communion or a meeting or an ecstasy, but much more about the possibility of a consuming of a new thrill, a new dimension, you know, and it's surrounded by media, whether that media is fashion or whether it's sexualized advertising on television or just, you know, sexual innuendos in all kinds of media. And so this is a place of enormous anxiety. Because what kind of community comes out of this kind of free-floating and commodified sexuality? So it's curious that the novels begin, as Tim LaHaye said, that they were inspired himself when he was traveling on an airplane and he saw a pilot flirting with a stewardess or with a flight attendant. He wondered, you know, what would be happening if at the moment that flirtation went on, the rapture occurred, and a final judgment on the flesh actually occurred. So here I think, whether we're really talking about a sexualization in a commodity way of the flesh, or in some sense a cybernization of the flesh, that all our bodily experiences are now hooked up to information systems, some directly, like being implanted into us, others just our environment, where we're always in and out of information flows. I mean, this unstabilizes us more than I think we had in the past, in terms of at least a technological ratcheting up, both in the possibilities of global destruction, but also an individual drift. So some desire, I think, to, you know, redraw these boundaries.
So this is like a resurrection of the pure body.
Well, in some sense it is.
As a response to a hybridization, post-human,
well, I mean, you say
all those
that
kinds of boundary crossings.
No, when you say it disturbs me, because I know Arthur sometimes uses the word, and I have also, fascism in talking about some aspects of new political formations of the moment. And now, fascism is a dangerous term to use in lots of ways, because I hear it being used from the right, too. So we use terms like Islamo-fascism, or we're really talking about feminism as a new form of Nazi fascism. And so it's an unstable term. But I'm very moved by going back to look at Klaus Teveleit's work on male fantasies, where he really talks about German culture during the rise of the Freikorps, which became the proto group that became the Nazis, consumed with this idea of the pure body. And we certainly understand the anti-Semitism among the Nazis, but he's actually saying that it really is a deep hatred of the flesh, and that in some sense Jews became associated with the body. Like women became associated with the body, like colonized people became associated with the body, as the colonizer was always mind above body.
Well, associated with the polluted body. I mean,
I think
there's two bodies here. I think you're really onto something very, very interesting. In terms of the United Nations theme, for example, it strikes me that the phantasmatic complex that's in play here has substituted the United Nations and the New World Order, led by secular humanists for the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And I think it's kind of interesting that in the so-called Clash of Civilizations, you've actually got a clash between, you know, the Antichrist, which is the United Nations vision of the world, versus the Jews running the world in terms of the literal truth of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Right.
You've got these enormous sort of world conspiratorial complexes. The thing that really worries me even more than any of this, perhaps about the LaHaye novels and the phenomena that's about, is that there's a sense that, maybe I'm wrong in the revival of this kind of religiosity in American culture, of a kind of wish to bring on the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have figures in government who believe in the imminence of the Day of Judgment, and this is also true in on the other side of the divide, Ahmadinejad also is living in the imminence of the Day of Judgment.
Right.
But, you know, it's like, bring it on.
Right.
Not just bring it on, bring on the enemy, but bring on the fire and brimstone, bring on the destruction. And it makes me uneasy that the world is in the hands of people whose deepest wish, perhaps, is that there be the destruction in order that there be the purification, in order that there be this other moment.
But maybe that's why the United States is Heidegger's society of completed nihilism, a great leader in the imperial project, that it's entered into a really completed nihilism, which is a society enters into its dying days. eating its excrement. It's like the bliss of radical negation and the ecstasy of apocalypse. So it strikes me, if you have the polluted body and you have this kind of sublimated condensations, while simultaneously seduced by the polluted body, and fearful and shutting down this kind of traumatic moment, you would anticipate something like the Left Behind novels would begin to emerge. Sort of one of these kind of ecstatic signs of end time, but not in any terminal sense. It strikes me, what's always been really novel and energizing about the United States, what makes it a world project, is in fact this excremental phase. It's its real life for us, because it's never been anything but this excremental phase of a society that celebrates its own bliss and radical negation itself. And that's why, I don't know, if, like the beginning of your paper, for example, which, you know, in your book, which is so great, you describe the two strands of thought between religion and civil democracy, civil society that exists, you know, relatively peacefully. Science takes one part, religion takes another. And then there's this third element, which is the element of fundamentalist religion begins to intervene. But do you think that's really true? Because when I go back, just go back to the Puritans, like, well, that didn't really exist. It was sort of, they brought in like a more rational interpretation of Jefferson later on, more rational interpretation of religion. But to go back to the founding religious spirit of the society, it was always really deeply eschatological, and it was always about radical negation. I'm back like in Boston, and I was thought at the time I spent at Boston College.
Yes,
I was reading that with sort of the sand dunes in mind and things like this. As the pilgrims were going through the sand dunes and looking for indigenous peoples who they had nothing but fear of and contempt for at one and the same time. And the fact that they began their punitive attitudes towards nature and towards indigenous peoples and animals and the whole land itself, because really it was just a rehearsal of what they had already done to themselves. It was in fact they'd already done this kind of radical negation of themselves in terms of putting their will down, making themselves, you know, testimonials of God's will.
Well, it seems, you know, I mean, really thinking historically about the questions you're raising seems crucial. Because in some ways the Puritans are at the forefront, and when they then mix with capitalism, I think the forefront even becomes escalated. And here's for a while where you have, you know, why Weber chooses even the United States as an example of kind of rational Protestantism, the Protestant ethic, the disciplining of emotion, the, you know, the rationality of judgment and stuff, which is always haunted by this other anxiety, I think, of having really disconnected in many deep ways from the natural world or from materiality in its complex ways. When we talk about the indigenous peoples of North America, you know, from the point of view of those who conquered them, these are primitive peoples. But one thing spiritually that they were, you know, and this is a term again that the colonizer invents for the people themselves, or animist, in some positive way that they were connected energetically and spiritually to the notion that the planet itself was alive. Something you today find in something like complex systems theory. I mean, really kind of the deepest levels of physics, that our own human flesh is connected to the atmosphere. If you took away oxygen, we wouldn't exist. We are interdependent in some sense. And the spiritual practices of the native peoples of North America, as the whole world in Europe, before the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, in many ways, the Puritans become, you know, like the Protestant Reformation, in some sense, you know, exaggerated, the place of attack on pagan peoples, which was thought of as the place of the devil, as opposed to the place of the earth. Most of Europe during the Middle Ages, where Christianity coexisted with a kind of animism that was thought of and in many ways colonized by Catholicism for its own hierarchical purposes.
I mean, the interesting thing here, then, it seems to me, is the way historically, so this account is the way in which the kind of Christian missionary approach to the New World amidst the pagans connects with the other thing that's been exported from the Old World through the colonization of America, which comes out of the Enlightenment, a kind of pure objectifying rationality.
Right, and
it's these two things which come together, it seems to me, which are really important in explaining this obliteration of the natural.
Well, I mean, in some sense, the history of the monotheisms, which, you know, is Judaism and Christianity and Islam, right, is in some sense, you know, the taking of a god out of nature so that God in some sense is supernatural or transcendental of living matter and all the rest needs to constantly be redeemed. But then the history of the Enlightenment is shifting that god into the figure of man, and I mean it somewhat gendered terms. And that sort of man with both God as his mission, but in some sense enlightenment as its future, that is, you know, a lot about the founding of America. But those are both anxious places if they in some ways don't allow us to have spiritual connections to matter. Not that it'll be redeemed through a final apocalypse or at the end of time, but literally in the interstices of everyday life. And there's always been parts of Christianity, I think, of sort of the versions of incarnational theology among people like Karl Rahner in a Jesuit Catholic tradition, you know, that really in some sense tried to interpret the meaning of Jesus becoming human as literally the redemption or the sense of the spiritualization of everything that is of the flesh, as the flesh is also connected living matter. But that's never been a project that's been allowed to realize itself socially or politically, particularly in some sense, I think, in realms of what you could call sort of greedy or capitalist economies, where some egoistic profit always has to rise above. I mean, so there's a kind of a superior ranking in the economy realm and stuff. And so the mixtures of spirituality, economics, and the various kinds of technologies of mastery that come out of those are always, it seemed like, a haunted place. If there is only transcendence as our true nature, well, then it makes sense to hasten the end of time, you know, the end of the anxious body, if that anxiety is brought from a real, genuine material disconnection that's exaggerated by, you know, material conditions that are everything about accumulation and profit rather than periodically, you know, in some sense, returning to matter itself.
But what about this other haunted space of what's happening immediately, the passion of the social in Seattle?
Yeah.
Yes. Well,
because it enters the same story, but enters it from a
it enters it in a different kind of way.
Does it, yeah.
And I mean,